Well, today we finally turn to the second part of the leadership process, that of culture and how you define culture, where you are, how you define what has to change about that culture in order for you to be a leader. And you're looking for a preferable future, and often that means a change within the cultures. But how do you define culture? Working within a culture is what leaders do. And so you've got to understand culture. Again, I don't have to go through that again for you. I don't think that's the leadership process. But I've been using this model to represent culture in that previous picture. And you'll notice it says visual elements of culture. The mission statement. In other words, there are words. There are stories. People will tell stories that will let you know something about who they are and what's important to them. There's the physical layout, how things are arranged within a building, say a lot about the culture in that place. The rules and policies, sometimes they'll have policies and you might, coming from outside, say, what? What is that all about? Or the rituals. And there are various other ways. We're going to look more fully at how you define the culture as we go through these next lessons together. But you'll be able to discover what the culture is there. But today, I want to begin by just trying to define what is culture as you work as a leader. Here's Webster's dictionary definition. The integrated pattern of human behavior that includes thought, speech, action, and artifacts. Now, an artifact is anything that's made or something that is solid that's there. Here's another leader's definition. The patterned way of life produced by a people through which its members are formed and shaped by the manner of their being. In other words, it's people being together and things just develop over a period of time. The way you live, the way you interact, all of that just develops. Here's the longest one by Terry Deal. Culture is a concept that captures the subtle, elusive, intangible, largely unconscious forces that shape a society or workplace. It is a potent shaper of human thought and behavior within organizations and even beyond its boundaries. Culture provides stability, fosters certainty, solidifies order and predictability, and creates meaning. Wow, that's a mouthful. Just look at that again. It captures subtle, elusive, intangible stuff. That forces that shape who we are and who the organization is and what they stand for and what they believe in. It provides stability for people. That's why it's hard to change. Fosters certainty, solidifies order and predictability, and creates meaning for people. So that's all stuff that goes into a culture. So what is it? It's a pattern. It's a pattern of the way people think. What do they believe is right? What do they believe is important? When people think a certain way, it impacts how they act and that they create the culture around that. Now, I remember reading years ago about a Baptist church. It was back in the time. I'm not saying anything to criticize Baptists here. It's just a story, a true one. But it was during a time when circuit riders would provide ministry to churches. So they didn't have many large churches when our country was expanding throughout this continent, the United States, which became the United States. And so circuit riders would ride from place to place and they'd preach the same sermon in four or five places. Well, there's this Baptist church that they had a discussion about whether they should put a peg in the wall. The peg would be to hang the preacher's cloak on, because back then when they were riding on horses and it would get muddy and they would get wet, and should they put a peg on the wall near the stove, which was near one part of the building, it's the only heat they had, should they put a peg up to hang that cloak on so it could dry and be warm for the preacher before he would take off to his next place? And a vigorous discussion ensued, because some people thought, this was part of their thinking process, that was ostentatious, that was just going beyond, that was trying to be special, to be different than the other churches in the circuit and all that sort of thing. Well, eventually the vote was taken, the majority won, they put a peg in the wall for the pastor's cloak to be hung on, and as a result there was a church split. And a group, small group from that church went over across the street and they built what they called the No Peg Baptist Church. And so the two churches there are Peg and No Peg Baptist Churches. See, thoughts. What do you believe is right? If you think that's ostentatious, well, then that's what happens. You act out what you think is right. So it's a pattern of thoughts. It's a pattern of words. Now, these words sometimes are official words. They're mission statements and vision statements. And we're going to talk about those more and how you form those more as we get into the next section of these classes together. But words are important in what people say. You'll notice that in subtle times. I've shared with you before about John Wimber, one of the founders of the Vineyard in Southern California, who built this large church, and they did it trying not to have theology. In other words, you had to say that you were a believer, that you were saved by grace through faith in Jesus Christ, and that's all you had to be to join that church. If you wanted to believe your children needed baptism, they'd baptize your children. If you believe only believers should be baptized, then that's what you do. If you wanted wine, you could have wine with your communion. If you wanted grape juice, et cetera, et cetera. He said he was so shocked after 1 year that he's walking on the way to the worship center and he hears someone saying, "That's not how we do it here." Because there are understandings about how we do it here, and somebody has said, "This is how we do it here." And he was becoming one of those people who was saying, "This is how we do it here." Words are very, very important. Then actions. How do people live out what they believe is right and true? The church I last served is meeting in an old piano factory, a 100-year-old building. It's got these old posts in it, and they chose to be as unfancy as possible. And I remember we were planning a building addition, and we had an intern with us who was learning how to do ministry, and he was trying to convince the planning team to get a little more fancy in their presentation, to say, you know, this is what it's going to look like. It's going to be great. Well, the value and the actions mean that we sat on plastic chairs and cement floors. Those were choices. The choice is to not refinish the beams, but to leave them rough from the days that people were working on pianos in there, building pianos. There are actions that are chosen. And then artifacts, which are anything that's been made. Those are important. If you ignore artifacts, you get in trouble. When I first went to my church in California, we had a huge pulpit, so much so you felt like you were being sucked into something, into a gloomy cave as you walked up into it. Only thing that would show of me is probably from here up. Excuse me, I just hit the microphone. But the only thing that would show is about from here up, because this thing was huge. And that's not my style. And as we thought about the culture in that area, we wanted to move to a more open style of presentation during the sermon. And so over a period of time, I managed to get that pulpit moved to a back room. And instead, we worked off a music stand. And that's how we preached, with our notes and Bible sitting on a music stand. Well, I went away for vacation for 3 weeks and came back, and the pulpit was back on the stage. And I was so mad that I went to the janitor, and I said, "Get that thing off there. Get it." And he said, "Well, what am I going to do with it?" I said, "I don't care if you break it up and burn it." So take it home, burn it in your fireplace, for all I care. Well, that just shook him up, and he ended up calling one of the fathers in the church, the church father people, and he came down, and thankfully he was aware. He says, you may not be aware of this, but that was a gift when this church was built, this first building. It was a gift from this family, and they're going to take great offense and others around them because they contributed to build this church pulpit furniture, etc. And so they came up with a better idea, and that is they went to a cabinet maker and they had it cut down into something that was usable, and we could say it's really the same stuff, just more today. But that was an artifact that was important. There are artifacts where you work and in your company, in your business, and in your church or ministry organization. So these are culture. Here's the way it boils down. This is the simplest explanation of culture I can give you. It's the way we do things here. Now, I just want to give some context to how that affects your planning. The way we do things here will affect how you go about planning your day and your life. First of all, the word culture first appears in a dictionary, an English dictionary, in 1430, and it meant to cultivate the soil. It's the same root as the word cultivate. And so Culture is something that cultivates the soil, but it grows something. That's the idea behind culture. It grows something. Now, cultures develop on several different levels. In fact, no matter the size of your organization, it will have a culture that will exist within a broader culture. In fact, I'm going to just talk for a bit about the macro culture. Wherever you are, there's a big culture that impacts your smaller culture of your organization, of your church. Now, I'm going to just describe the move of culture in the United States. Now, if you don't live in the United States, as many of you do not, you're going to have to place that ideas onto your situation. What's happened in your history? How can you see culture changing? Now, for instance, if you go back to 1900 in the United States, you'll find an economy that was pretty simple. There were no credit cards. You rarely borrowed money from the bank. You always did things that you paid for it as you went. That was the way life was done. Church life was the center. You were the center of the world back then. Your church life impacted you every day. In fact, in my heritage, what would happen is you'd get up in the morning, you'd put the wagon together, you'd get the horses hitched on, and you would go into church. After church, you'd have a potluck dinner, and then you'd stay for an afternoon service at 2 o'clock, and then you'd take the horse team and wagon and go back home. Now, that was a church life, but you'd be back there during the week. Church life was engaged everywhere in your life. There was no children's ministry. Sunday school started as a means to teach children who didn't get education because they were working in the factories before there were child labor laws. And so there wasn't really a children's ministry. That was believed to be up to you as a parent to teach your child. There wasn't a youth ministry. The young men and young women worked on the farm, and that's where they learned how to do life. Agriculture was the name of the day. Everybody worked within, not everybody, but most people worked on farms and producing crops. And family structure, families were close. In fact, no family probably lived more than 7 miles away from where the parents lived. Okay, 1920, that all began to change. Major events, there had been a world war, and some of our soldiers had gone over to Europe, and they'd seen a bigger world and experienced a bigger world, and as a result, their world began to expand. And the automobile came into its own in the 1920s. And began to become a major force as Henry Ford provided automobiles that people could afford. And it was found that you could go further than on a horse, and you could go there, hopefully, more conveniently by driving an automobile. So the culture began to change around those two forces. By the time you get to the 1940s, there's been a time of depression that impacted our culture greatly for decades. My father was a product of the Depression. He grew up then. He was dating my mother toward the end of that time of Depression. And he was somebody who never bought a new pants or new shirt. I never remember him buying ever a new pants or new shirt. He bought everything at a rummage sale or at a Salvation Army or thrift store somewhere. That's where he got his clothes because he couldn't spend good money for just clothing. And he was intent on saving. Those people who came out of the Depression knew that things could go bad. And so they were trying to save their money. And again, there was a war going on in Europe at that time. And during this time, the Americans joined that war. And it changed so many people's experience, especially their experience of faith. For some, it was a deepening experience. I'll talk about that in a moment. I had an uncle who went off to war, and he was planning to do a business or work in a factory, and he ended up coming back and saying, I've got to go into ministry. This world is not a nice place, and it needs Jesus. There's a move to the cities. Out of the farming communities, young men and women streamed to the cities to work in the factories that were now booming after World War II. So a major change in culture there. 1960s, there was societal upheaval. The hippies began to challenge everything, and Vietnam and all of the protests against that war seemed to just tear at the whole fabric of our society. And as a result, people began being mistrustful of people in leadership. They felt like they were lied to. Whereas before this, you trusted your leaders. We had these quality leaders in government, and you trusted them. But now people were wondering, and were protesting decisions made by the government. 1980s, globalization was the word. All of a sudden now, we are working as a global economy, not just the economy of the United States. And so we are dependent on other nations for things like gasoline coming in and our crops going out because we produce more than we need to eat. And electronics. Wow, you know, it's hard for me to remember what it's like to function without a cell phone. That was a huge thing. So all of this is part of the culture. So when we look at the culture, we got to say there's been a flow to it. But what is it like today? Now, when I consider the culture in the United States, I also have to look at the role of the church, because that's been very important in who we are as a country. Now, if you look at 1900 from the point of view of the church, where was the church? It was in the center of the community. I had the privilege in 1991 of spending time at Harvard University in Boston, Massachusetts, and I was there as a research a specialist, and I was there to write a book on revival periods in the United States, and you may have taken the course where I share more about that. But one of the places we went as a family was to visit Lexington and Concord, where the Revolutionary War started that created the United States eventually. And where are the churches? Well, there's a village green. There's a green area in the center of the village. And on the edge of the green are all the important buildings. And what are the important buildings? Stores and churches. Churches. Church was the center of life. Everything revolved around the church there. That's the way it was in the 1900s, and it was that way until the 1920s. But now, in the 1920s, we were getting more prosperous as a nation and as a people, and the roaring 20s, you see the church starting to drift away from that center position as more and more people are questioning it, particularly after World War I. Prior to World War I, there were theologians who thought that the millennial reign of Jesus Christ that's mentioned in Revelation was just going to be developed naturally because we were learning so much and there was so much progress in society that eventually we would just usher in that time naturally. But World War I just shook that faith and said, you know, things are really bad. Why would I be part of a church that teaches what it does? And so the church was beginning to be marginalized. There was a return in the 1940s during the Second World War. During a time of crisis, people always turned to faith. And that's what they did back then, as they had sons and husbands and fathers over in Europe fighting. Now people were praying back home for safety. As more and more gold stars showed up in windows, the symbol of somebody, a relative, close relative, who had been killed from that household, people were in churches, and they were there faithfully because they wanted and needed God, because things were outside of their control. And so there was a slight movement back. During major crises, that's always happened in the United States, there's a slight movement back. But it doesn't last, you see. After 9/11, when the Muslim extremists attacked the Twin Towers in New York here, the next Sunday, worship attendance was up 20% in our country. Can you imagine? There's nothing we could do that could do that. And yet, over the next 6 weeks, it went back to normal because it was only a crisis, and it had followed that way. 1960s, you find the church getting pushed out as the society becomes more secular, as people become less dependent on the church, as the fabric of society seems to be falling apart. So it's pushed to the edges. By the 1980s, as prosperity keeps on pushing the church out, that's where the church ends. It's on the edge now, and it's consulted. Now, in the United States in the 80s, you couldn't be president of the United States. You wouldn't get elected a senator or a representative. You probably wouldn't be elected to local government unless you were a member of a church in good standing. By 1980, that's changing. By the year 2000, where's the church? It's outside the circle. We're now being referred to as a post-Christian nation. That's part of the culture. If we're going to work here in a Christian organization, is we have to realize that the culture is now post-Christian. In other words, up until about the 1960s, everyone knew the basics of the Christian message, that man is sinful, God sent Jesus Christ to die for our sins, and as a result, he offers us the gift of eternal life and allows us to live with him forever in heaven. People knew the basics. But now that's starting to fall apart. And what are people looking for in the culture now? What are they looking for in religion? Back in the 60s, as the 60s were coming to an end, the World Council of Churches engaged a man named Dean Kelly to study what was happening in the United States, because for the first time, membership in mainline churches was on the decline. And so why is that? Why are churches losing their members, and why are churches losing their influence within the culture? And then a flip side of that was, why are some churches growing? There were fundamentalist churches that were growing. There were very, very conservative churches that remained growing during that whole time. Why that? And his conclusion was this, that during times of crisis, or when things are moving so fast and things are uncomfortable for many people, what they look for out of their religion is stability. And so the fundamentalist churches offer stability, whereas the mainline churches offer what people saw as an accommodation to culture, and they became less about the message of the gospel and more about social work and social blessing of people as the alternative. So now we're outside. We're not consulted. And we have a choice to make about how we respond to that in a post-Christian world. You know, one of the ways we've tended to respond over the last 20 years or so, maybe a little longer, is we've tried to get power back. We want to move back to the center. And we find that the world doesn't take to that very well. In my own small community, we had a big to-do a couple years ago, because we had a cross on the hill that overlooked the city. And on Sundays, they would put this cross up. It was an identification, just a reminder that, you know, we're Christians. Well, somebody sued the city because they said, I'm not a Christian. I don't want that up there. And it's on public land. It should not be there. And so there's a big discussions throughout the town. There were all kinds of discussions. And there were Christians who were trying to fight this, saying, but if we could put a wood cross in every lawn just that wants to have the cross there, then the city will buckle to us and we'll have the cross. And there were others who were saying, Why do we need a cross there? It's more important that we live the cross, isn't it? That we live as representatives of Jesus in this community. So we got to make some decisions about how we respond. But today, as we're looking at the church, the way we respond that is needed is the church has to be the presence of Jesus Christ in the world. And not politically powerful, but caring about people and healing people. And so as we relate to the culture around us, which now no longer respects us or sees us just as one option out of many, we have to find ways to do that. Now, that's just a quick review to encourage you to look at your macro culture in your country or in your community. What is the culture like? What about the way they do things here? What kind of actions and words and rituals and stories make up that culture in which you have to work? In what is the big culture in which your company exists, or your business, or your church, or your ministry? What is that like as you start thinking about a culture within your business? We'll talk about that beginning next time. What does that look like for you? Because you're going to have to figure out how you respond to that culture. Because one of the things that leaders do is they lead people to start thinking about how to change culture. So, see you next time as we continue this discussion.